Okay, so I had a job in San Francisco, surfing the web and sending internet jokes to my friends. Kinda. Actually, my job title was legislative analyst for what other places call the city council. Sounds okay, right? I was supposed to figure out the impact of various legislation and write reports about it. Talk about how the rubber actually hits the road. And I wanted to write these reports. I really did. I wanted to be in the game. Out on the byway of City Hall, things were bustling. Important-looking people with suit coats and briefcases. They walked with quick steps, making big moves, breaking into tense meetings. It was exciting. Time stood still for no one. Things had to be decided right now. Until you arrived at our little office. Where time had ceased her movement. Tick-tock. Tick-tock. So slowly. We moved so slowly. Four cubicles. Boss Lady 1. Boss Lady 2. Paula. And myself. See, in order to fight time, our office had instituted procedure. A city council member would rush in, demand to know right away what would happen if they strapped submachine guns to the roofs of school buses. But first, they had to make a formal request. Boss Lady Number 2 had 24 hours to review the request before passing it on to Boss Lady Number 1, who had 24 hours to review the review. And she had another 24 hours to assign the report. And then they inserted 24 hours for nothing at all. By this time, of course, the council member had forgotten about the machine gun thing. Instead, he wanted to know where the gold was buried in Golden Gate Park. But of course, that too required formal paperwork be submitted, and so on. And so on, until I thought I was going to lose my mind. It was horrible. Other City Hall people were living, whereas we were dying. 1 second at a time, dying. And those other people, they were the folk I needed to impress. The future congressmen, the future mayors, the senators. I had to break this space-time continuum, and I didn't know how to do it. And one day, on the way back from my 15th bathroom break, something magical happened. The council member looked up and saw me, and he said, "Hey, why don't you write me up a report on something ridiculous I just thought up?" And in this situation, face-to-face with the man who would be mayor, did I tell him to fill out the paperwork and wait for a forever review? No. I said, "Yes, sir. I have it on your desk first thing tomorrow morning." I went back to my office, said nothing to the boss ladies, just pounded that report out, had it on the council member's desk that morning like I said I would. And it felt good. Felt like I was finally doing something. Felt like I was in the game. You know, so I kept wandering the halls. "How you doing, big commissioner? Looking good, council member, looking good." It worked. Sure enough, they started asking me for stuff.
"Glenn, I wonder if you can look into nationalizing the banks."
Yes, I can.
"Glenn, can we declare war on Los Angeles?"
I'll let you know, council member. I wrote reports, handed them out like candy. Council members loved it. I loved it. It was almost like I had a real job. And one day, one of them breached our office cubicle time barrier, rushed into the workspace to shout loudly,
"Glenn, that was the best damn report I've ever read. Good work."
He turns, leaves, and this is the worst thing he could have done, because Boss Lady Number 2 says, "Rot report." And Boss Lady Number 1 says, "Rot report." And then together, "Did you write a report without going through the proper protocol?" Uh-oh. The unpardonable sin. D deny, deny, deny. I say, of course not. No way. He must have had me confused with someone that actually does something. But now, the boss ladies are on to me. They're watching me like a hawk, and I've got all these reports I promised to get out, things to do. They hear me typing furiously away in my cubicle, desperate to fight the stoppage of time.
Glenn, what are you doing over there?
I'm just searching the internet for Bigfoot sightings.
Well, okay then. As long as you're not writing any reports until they're assigned to you through the proper procedure.
They're temporarily off the trail. Until a council member cites one of my secret reports in one of his speeches. Uh-oh! I get a message in my inbox that Boss Lady Number 1 and Boss Lady Number 2 want a meeting right away, right this moment, right now. Which, thankfully, in our no-time portal, takes about a month to actually schedule. Time I use to get a resume in the hands of every single council member. They all say,
Glenn, you're great, but after working with the legislative analyst, we don't feel you can operate within the hectic go-go pace of a politician's office. But thanks. Thanks so much for stopping by.
I'm tainted. It's guilt by association, and I want to scream. The meeting with the boss ladies comes, and I'm thinking, fire me. Go ahead, fire me, fire me, fire me, fire me. I dare you to fire me. And I think they do fire me. It's just that time moves so slowly, it's hard for me to even concentrate on what they're saying. Something about,
your problem is that you're hostile to the chain of command.
Chain of command. I turn in my badge, I turn in my keys, I escape back out into real time, I suck real time air, and I'm smiling. Wondering what I'm gonna do, but I'm smiling. You see, it really is better to be jobless in real time than to be stuck in no time at all. Today in Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Chain of Command. Amazing stories from real people desperate to follow the correct protocol or not. My name is Glenn Washington. Get your papers nicely stacked in alphabetical order because you're listening to Snap Judgment.
Now then, it's all well and good to fight the chain of command when it's just yourself on the line. But what if you have a bunch of people depending on every single decision you make? Our first story today on the Chain of Command episode occurs on the streets of Iraq. Sensitive listeners should be aware, all of these scenes occur during a war zone, and as such, it does contain some violence.
For 13 months, Matt Cook managed to stay alive as an infantry soldier in Iraq.
My platoon was hit by, we know we kind of lost count, but maybe 15 to 18 IEDs. It soured me on Iraqis, and I think that's kind of an inevitable reaction to something like that when, you know, you lose really good friends. So the last bullet I fired from my rifle, we were, I think, about a month from going home. I think we were all really, really cautious because we've just survived 12, 13 months. You know, you don't want to take too many risks this close to making it through. It was afternoon, just before it gets dark. We're in Humvees. We're all in our gear, our vests, our body armor. We'd stopped traffic in both ways. We had our chem lights out. We had some cones out. Everything possibly that we could signal traffic to stop was out. And in the middle of it, one of my soldiers who's in the Humvee screams, "There's a car coming." I turn to look, and I see this sedan, and it's just flying at us. It picks up speed as it comes towards us. You know, you don't have but a few seconds to decide what to do. I've been in this situation, you know, many, many times with my platoon, and I think, is this going to be another situation where we shoot a civilian, or is this a situation where if I don't do anything, is this a car bomb and it's going to get inside our circle and blow us all up? I don't have time to really think this through because things are happening so quickly. So I looked at my weapon and I was watching him, you know, watching the car come at us through my ACOG, which is the scope of my rifle. I flip my safety to fire and I've got my finger on the trigger. Pulled the trigger, shot several times. I see my rounds enter this guy, and the ACOG on our weapons magnify really well. So he was wearing a white man dress, and I could just see my rounds going into him and polka dotting his white man dress with blood. And then, you know, he just stops, the car stops, and he slumps over. And I turn my back to it, thinking it's going to blow up and kill us all, to be perfectly honest. And then after a second or two, nothing happens, and I slowly turn around, and I see this old man leaning against his door, motionless. He was dead. I circle around the car. The glass is all broken, and there's several bullet holes in his vehicle. His car's smoking, and I pull him out onto the street, and his eyes are wide open, and I immediately notice that they're just gray, and they're covered with cataracts, and that he's probably damn near blind. Which is why he came at us. And while I'm searching the car, you know, I look at his glove box, and inside his glove box, he has his wallet. And that's where I find a picture of him with a young man. He's got his arm around this young man, and I'm only assuming that it was his son.
And at that moment, Matt, what did you feel, if anything?
It's hard to describe something like that. I'm in the middle of a really complicated place where people are out to kill us. And so I think I've done what I had to do to protect myself and to protect my soldiers.
And is there any guilt in there?
Well, I think it's hard to feel guilty in a moment like that when you've spent a year in a place where you've genuinely felt like everyone is trying to kill you. And it does, if you feel too guilty, then you begin to hesitate. What if that old man had actually been driving a bomb-laden vehicle? I knew I had to bury it and then deal with it later.
And when you went home, did you think about that old man when you were home?
I would say I knew that I should feel guilty, but I didn't. You know, my morals and everything I was ever taught about humanity, you know, is questioned because I know what I did, and but I did not feel overwhelmingly guilty about it. What really wrecked me, I think, was this sort of survivor's guilt that, you know, I had a few friends and a soldier who I lost, and the lingering sort of sorrow I felt for their loss was something I had to deal with in a much more difficult way than, you know, say the old man, for instance. When I got back from my first deployment, I felt very unfulfilled. I felt like there was a lot of unfinished business in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and I really had a real desire to return. I knew I wanted to do a story, and I wanted to write about it. And then I contacted my old battalion commander, chatted with him about the possibility of doing it. Maybe it's extreme, but I felt like going back and embedding with my old unit was what I was really looking for. And it all happened very quickly, and Once I fully committed and kind of bought my ticket, a sort of peace came over me about it, and I went from nervous to being just very, very excited. It was almost like getting ready for another deployment. When I got to the airport in Kabul, this one was incredibly different. You know, you're on your own, completely on my own, and I didn't have the support of 25, 26 well-armed men, you know, ready to jump on a grenade for me if I needed. I had no weapon. I just had my camera and my pack. And I genuinely started second-guessing myself in that moment. I was thinking about, I would be lying if I said I didn't think about just getting a return ticket and going back home. But Saeed, my driver, finally calls and tells me that he's outside. I just sort of took a deep breath and just stepped out, and we took off. So I rolled down my window and I was just smelling the city, looking at everything, and I had my cell phone and I did type in a message to my wife in case anything were to happen. I was just going to hit send. I think the message that I had typed was "need help, call embassy" or something like that. We were on our way to Bagram. He's driven this road how many times? So he knows the road, and he's weaving in and out of traffic. We're cruising down this road and we're going really fast, and we kind of turn this bend, and I see this Afghan police unit or army unit checkpoint, and they're stopping traffic. And Saeed just paying no attention whatsoever. He's just flying at this checkpoint. And I look at the Afghan soldiers, and I see them see us, and I see them really tense up and posture up. I mean, I had seen it so many times from the other end. Hit the imaginary brake below me, and, you know, I screamed at Saeed to stop. That's when he kind of jolts, and he finally sees this Afghan unit on the street. They immediately raise their rifles at us. The dishka on the truck turns, and I couldn't, you know, maybe half a second away from shooting at us. He slams on the brake, and we slide onto the shoulder of the road. They run at the car, and they've got their AKs at our heads, and I was frozen. It was probably the scariest few moments of my life. We were really lucky to be alive, because if I had been them, I think I would have pulled the trigger, and I probably would have done it much sooner. There's no way I would have risked myself or any of my soldiers for moments of hesitation.
So why do you think they didn't shoot? Why were they so slow on that trigger where maybe you wouldn't have been?
That's a good question. I've thought about that, but the truth is you just can't compare them to the U.S. forces. They know the culture, and they know the dangers more than we do. When you're a soldier in a foreign country, everybody seems dangerous. Everybody seems out to kill you. There's a term called pseudo-speciation, which is when a soldier identifies the entire race of a country as an enemy because he is under attack. I was in a state of shock, to be honest with you. I hadn't had a rifle pointed at me in a long time. One of the first things I thought of was that old man that I had killed in Iraq. I think for the first time, it really hit me. And this old man, I remember so specifically, I think, because when you're in combat, a lot of times everybody's shooting their weapons. So you don't really know if it's your round hitting someone. And with the old man, I could see my rounds hitting him through my ACOGs. He'd gotten so close to us. The weight of those consequences really, really sunk in. And I think thinking about this old man really kind of turned me inside out, to be honest with you.
What do you mean?
I always knew that what happened was a horrible thing, but I never really felt it. I felt it for the first time in a way that I had never felt before, but kind of knew that I should have. Does that make sense? It made me kind of realize how maddening the whole thing is.
We would like to thank Matt Cook for sharing his experience with the Snap. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. And when Snap Judgment, the Chain of Command episode continues, we find out just how far, exactly how far, a little kid Push's grandmother. For real. When Snap Judgment Storytelling with a Beat continues after the break, stay tuned. Snap Judgment, the Chain of Command episode. Today, we're highlighting stories from people who do what they're told and from people who do not. Now, you may or may not know this, but every once in a while, Snap Judgment takes it on the road. No studio tricks, no redos, no CGI special effects. Snap storytellers walk the narrative plank and bare their souls on stage. Backed by the best band in radio. It is hot. So, we're going to drop you right into the very best seat in the house, front and center, so you can get an early taste of a recent live show the Snap crew did in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was amazing. We'll have the full show very soon. Today, you get to hear a Snap Judgment favorite rock the house with a story about someone very dear to him. Snap Judgment, live.
Ha, ha.
Today's next performer was with Snap Judgment from day one. He's a poet, a teacher, a man with a heart as big as a Michigan lake. Please put your hands together for Mr. Josh Healy.
My grandmother was a sweet little old lady who baked the best chocolate chip cookies ever, who stood 4'11" in heels, and who at one time was the highest-ranking woman in the American Communist Party. It's true. It's true. My grandmother, Dorothy Ray Healy, was the head of the Communist Party in Los Angeles from 1945 to 1968, all throughout the 1950s, which, from what I've heard, was an awesome time to be a communist in America. Joe McCarthy, that dude loved my grandma. He loved her so much, he sent her to jail 3 times. And all 3 times, she appealed her case to the Supreme Court and won her freedom. Now, when I was born, grandma moved from LA to DC to help raise me and my brother. We called her Comrade Granny. And when I was 10 years old, Comrade Granny took me to a protest that helped shape my own politics to this day. There was a strike out in the Maryland suburbs, so Grandma and I went out to join the picket line. Nothing new so far, just another day in the struggle. But when we get to the factory, I look up at the sign over the gates, and I can't believe it. I don't want to believe it. There, staring at me from the sign above the factory gates, were these huge images of red licorice and purple lollipops and every dark, delicious flavor of chocolate possible. I said, Grandma, are we protesting a candy factory? And she said, no, Joshy, we're protesting the candy factory owners who aren't giving their workers a living wage. I can't believe this. I can't believe this. I mean, I'm 10 years old. I'm standing in front of the real-life version of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, and you're telling me I can't go inside and swim in the chocolate waterfall? Taste the lollipop trees? Now that is an injustice. But here we are, outside the gates, and there's about 100 people in the picket line, and Grandma and I join in, and we start marching in a circle, and we're chanting for justice. But the truth is, I'm not thinking about workers' rights or living wages. All I can think about is that sign and how I can get inside for 1 second and have one taste of that sweet, sugary goodness. So I go up to Grandma and I ask in my nicest little 10-year-old grandson voice possible, I say, Grandma, do you think I can go inside and maybe they'll give me a little candy? But Comrade Granny don't play that. She says, Joshy, I am very disappointed in you. We've taught you in this family you do not cross picket lines. You don't want to be a scab, do you? A scab. A scab. Now, you know, a scab is technically just the replacement worker a company brings in during a strike. But to true activists like my grandmother, a scab is the worst thing in the world that you could call someone. A traitor to the working class. An Uncle Tom in a room full of Black Panthers. When Grandma asked me if I'm going to be a scab, I say, no. I'll be good, Grandma. I promise. And she says, good, but if you are getting a little hungry, why don't you just go get something from the hot dog stand down the block? So I start walking, and I'm walking, and I'm about halfway down the block when all of a sudden, I see it. There, on the back side of the factory, is an open window. No way. And I look around, and I don't see Grandma, and I don't see anyone. So technically, I wouldn't be crossing the picket line, right? I'd be going around it. So I jump over the little factory fence. I race across the parking lot. I scramble up a dumpster, and one step at a time, I climb inside the open window. I'm in! I'm inside the candy factory! And it's not exactly what I expected. There's no chocolate waterfalls. There's no lollipop trees. But there are assembly lines and conveyor belts. And wait, oh, a huge, massive crate filled with thousands, millions of dark, freshly packaged chocolates. And so, I tiptoe my way over to the crate. And right as I'm about to put my hand in and grab a piece, I hear behind me, "Hey, you!" And I turn around. But it's no security guard. It's a kid. A little kid with big freckles, even younger than me. And he says, "Hey, you! This is awesome! I'm Bobby. Let's get some candy!" And so he takes a piece from the crate and starts eating it. So I take a piece from the crate and I start eating it. And then another, and then another, and then another. And before you know it, I've got chocolate all over my hands and chocolate all over my face and chocolate on the back of my neck. And I'm like, I look at him and I'm like, Bobby, this is amazing. How did you get in? And Bobby's like, you see that guy over there working that big machine? That's my dad. And I nearly choke on my chocolate. Bobby's dad is a scab? Does that make Bobby a scab? And since I'm in here eating this piece, what does that make me? I look over and I say, I gotta go, man. Thanks for the candy, Bobby. And I tiptoe back to the window and I climb out. I scramble down the dumpster. I cut across the parking lot. I jump over the little factory fence and run back out to the front. And when I reach the front, the strikers aren't marching in a circle anymore. They're just standing in front of the factory gate, arms crossed. The factory whistle blows. It's shift change, and a row of cars filled with scabs starts trying to make its way right through the picket line. The strikers are pushing back, pushing against their windows, shouting at them to go home. And four big cops are shoving the strikers back, moving them with their batons. And Grandma is right up there at the front of the picket with the strikers marching, shouting, "Solidarity forever! Solidarity forever!" I look over. I see Bobby sitting on the curb, looking around for his dad, trying not to cry. And here I am, right in the middle. I've got Grandma on one side, Bobby on the other, a pocket full of chocolate burning its way through my jeans. What should I do? And 5 minutes later, things start to calm down. Some of the strikers, some of the scabs made their way through. Some of them decided it wasn't worth it and go home. Grandma and I, we start making our way back to our car. I look on the other side of the street, see Bobby walking with his dad. And I look up at my grandma, and I'm nervous. But I ask her, I say, Grandma, if you're the son of a scab, does that make you a scab? And she says, no, Joshy, it doesn't. Just like being the son of an activist doesn't make you an activist. Everyone has to decide for themselves. Why do you ask? And I take a deep breath and I reach into my pocket. I pull it out. And I show her. And when I do, I can see the anger and the disappointment all over her face. And she says, give me that. And I do. And I hang my head. But when I look up again, I see something different. I see my grandma, my first real comrade, look at me and see her 10-year-old grandson. And she says, well, Joshy, there's really only one thing we can do at this historical moment. And she takes the candy and she breaks it in half. She gives half to me and pops the other half in her mouth. And she says, as Marx would say, it's always better to share the wealth.
big thanks to Josh Healy. That piece is performed for Snap Judgment Live in Ann Arbor. The full live show will be available soon. And that original score was written by Alex Mandel and performed by Alex Mandel and the Snap Judgment players, Tim Frick and David Brand. The piece was mixed by our own Pat Nassidi Miller. Now, don't go anywhere, because when Snap Judgment returns, a doctor finally gets his chance to look evil directly in the eye. For real, when Snap Judgment, the Chain of Command episode continues, stay tuned. It's almost time. Snap Judgment, Storytelling with the Beat, is coming to Los Angeles, live. October 12th, 8 p.m. Get your tickets right now at snapjudgment.org. Snap Judgment Live, L.A. In conjunction with our host station, KPCC, do not miss it. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Chain of Command episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're exploring what happens when you follow orders and what happens when you don't. Our next story comes to Snap from an Iraqi medical doctor, a man named Dr. Malfak El Rabahi. And while he is an excellent doctor, it's his passion for political action that's really defined him. And when he was younger, it's this passion that got him into trouble.
I went to prison three times. I was tortured badly, physical torture and psychological torture. During the torture, the man in front of me was Saddam Hussein. Well, not literally, but the officer who was torturing me, I can see through him Saddam Hussein's eyes and Saddam Hussein as a man who is behind the steering wheel. He is the real butcher all over the country. He just execute people left, right, and center. When I was released from prison last time, I was literally dying. And no hospital could give me any treatment, any medical treatment. They will ask me what happened. And I have to disclose that I was in the General Intelligence Agency and I was tortured. And then they will show me the door. My mother was admitted to the medical city, the largest hospital in Baghdad, and she needed kidney dialysis. And from the medical city, an intelligence officer called me saying that, well, if you don't come and hand over yourself to the authorities, we will deny your mother of any dialysis. They were basically blackmailing me. This is a man you cannot do business with. This is a man you cannot trust. So I thought that my mother would not be given the dialysis and I will be executed immediately. I said, no way. She was denied the treatment she deserves because of me and my political activities. My mother died a few days later. That's what Saddam has done to me. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh dear. This is, you cannot describe this honestly. I went through a really, really very bad bereavement period. But when after a few months, it gave me more resolve and it enabled me. It gave me more energy, if you like.
Baghdad tonight, under heavy bombardment on the day the war started. American and British troops are in action on land, sea...
The Americans, they formed the Iraqi Governing Council. And I was one of the members, of the founding members of, if you like, New Iraq. I took active part in the search for Saddam Hussein. I had a call. He said, well, Muwaffaq, I wanted to see you rather urgently. We think that we got Saddam Hussein. I was really excited. I said, show it to me. We went through a metal detector, and I was the first to go into the room. Very strange feeling. Curiosity, believing, not believing. And I, in my mind, Saddam, who has done all these crimes, I'm going to see probably a Superman or a giant, something, not a human creature. So with this thinking, I went into the room and I saw a small, miserable, miniature human being sitting on an edge of a bed. I mean, I know him from the first moment. I lived with him for, not literally living him, but I throughout, he painted my life. I did not say Assalamu Alaikum. He was head hanging down on his chest, and I said, Saddam Hussein. He raised his head and looked at me, and I said, Saddam, may God curse you. What have you done with us? You brought us to this. My colleagues left the room. I was the last to leave. I did not want to leave the room. I have so many things to ask him. Let me confess to you, and probably this is the first time I ever mentioned this. I stood up, and he was sitting. And he was really, really weak and thin. It went through my mind to put him to sleep forever. It will take me only 2.5 or maximum 3 minutes. It went through my mind. I will go and apply my weight and my finger around his throat and finish the man. In the days before the execution, I was praying to God that the sooner we get rid of this man, the better. Because I was hoping that this will heal my inside. The night before, I was asked to attend the execution by the Prime Minister as a national security advisor to make sure that everything goes smoothly. I was not aware that I'm the one who is going to have to pull the lever. If somebody has told me, you are now being tortured by Saddam, in 30 years or 40 years from now, you will be doing the execution for Saddam Hussein by your own hand, I would have probably laughed and ridiculed him. The moment of truth came. It was 4:30 in the morning. It was dark. I received Saddam Hussein in the doorstep, outside the house of the execution. I led him to the execution chamber. The whole environment, that room, was full of death. I can smell death. I can see death. I can feel death. My goodness. It is the strangest feeling I have ever seen in my life. I could not describe it. See, I am a doctor, and I have hundreds of patients dying in front of my eyes. But it's a completely different kettle of fish from you sending somebody to death. Somebody who's fit as fiddle, you bring him up, and you actually carry the professional killing, if you like, on that person. It's a different feeling. It's a completely different feeling. He looked me in the eye, and I looked him in the eye. I didn't want to blink. And that went really long, staring at each other. I was thinking that he would be remorseful. God, be compassionate to me. Because that's the moment of the truth. That's the moment of truth, isn't it? He has never done that. He was given the opportunity, well, he was reminded, prompted, to say there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. So he said, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad his. And then the liver went down, and he went down, and he instantaneously died. It's one of the most, well, it's not one of the most, the most unpleasant feeling I have ever seen in my life. And I went through a very difficult time in my life during torture and all this. This is worse than going through torture. This is the worst feeling you can ever have in your life. Ending life of somebody. I went back to my house and I talked to my wife. And my wife saw me. She said, I have never seen you in this deplorable state of affair. Never seen you like this in my life. This is Muwaffaq I do not recognize. She said, what did you do? What happened? Why did you do it? Why do you have to do it? I said, I did the right thing. I should have done it. It has to be done. And somebody has to do it. And that somebody happened to me to be me. It's not a vendetta. Honest to God, when I looked him in the eye, before I took him to the gallows, I did not feel that I am taking a revenge against him. I felt this is a duty, my security duty as well as my medical duty. I was prepared to reconcile with anyone who is reconcilable. Anyone. Regardless of his past, anyone. But see, there is something you need to understand. There is a limit. Hitler, Mussolini, these horrible people. Saddam Hussein is one. I'm grateful to God that I saw the end of Saddam Hussein before I leave this life.
Thank you to the good doctor for sharing that incredible story with Snap. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with assistance by Julia DeWitt. Sound design by Renzo Gorio. You've reached the end of this chapter of Snap Judgment, but the entire book remains unread. Full episodes, movies, pictures, stuff. Available right now, Snap Nation, at snapjudgment.org. Facebook,
Snap judgment. What else would you do on Facebook? You've already stalked your high school sweethearts. It's time to do something for you. Our Twitter handle, SnapJudgmentORG. Snap was produced by myself and a team that would never, ever, never, never, ever break the chain of command. No way. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. The rocker, Pat Massidi Miller. Anna, the Jig Sussman. Stephanie, the Pop Locker Foo. Disco Renzo Gorio. Julia Salsa DeWitt. The River Dancer, Nick Vanderkolk. And the only man in public radio who can spin on his head. Snap Judgments, Will Urbina. Our crack production squad, Beth Morgan, Ruth Sadie, Nicholas Lofredo, and Jasmine DaCosta. Now, perhaps you've poured yourself a big bowl of cereal, turned onto the cartoon marathon, got the carton of milk out of the refrigerator only to discover it's empty. Drained of even the last drop. Who drank all the milk and stuck the carton back in the fridge? It was the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they are not sorry, and they do not offer an apology. But much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, does not exchange people for public radios, but does exchange public radios for people. PRX.org. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you could tell someone to do something. They could tell someone else to do it, and they could tell someone else until someone tells you to do what you said in the first place, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.